Thousands of people march in Washington, D.C. to back the U.S. president's claims of election fraud as he pushes ahead with legal challenges to overturn his rival's projected victory. Russia reports a record daily increase of nearly 23,000 new coronavirus infections, taking the national tally to nearly 2 million. Also in the headline, German police fire water cannons to disperse people protesting in Frankfurt against the government's measures to halt the rise in coronavirus infections. Welcome to the program. Our top story, supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump have held a mass protest in Washington, D.C. against what they describe as vote rigging. Various far-right groups and militias, including Proud Boys, took part in the protest. Demonstrators urged Trump not to concede defeat to his Democratic rival Joe Biden. Trump personally drove through the cheering crowd in his motorcade, waving to his supporters. He later tweeted that people are not going to stand for having the election stolen from them by the radical left. Joe Biden was proclaimed by media as the winner of the 2020 presidential vote last Saturday. However, Trump has rejected that result and launched legal challenges based on claims of fraud. A correspondent in Washington, D.C., Wyatt Reed, says small scuffles broke out during the rally between Donald Trump supporters and counter-protesters.
Well, I'm out here outside Harry's Restaurant and Hotel Harrington. It's long been known as a hangout, a favorite hangout of the Proud Boys, and true to form, they are here today. Probably at least 100 of them have been congregating at the corner here. Now, I have noticed over the past half hour, small scuffles, interactions, arguments with those who are opposed to Donald Trump, to his presidency, and what they describe as his racist, white supremacist policies. The Proud Boys themselves have been going through internal divisions with a significant wing wishing that they would stop, as he saw it, and Enrique Tarrio saw it, stop disguising their beliefs in the language of Western chauvinism and just begin openly identifying as white supremacists. There's a significant number within the Proud Boys that feel very strongly in favor of that suggestion. And we're seeing some of it tonight, you know, lots of racially loaded language being used, lots of suggestions about welfare being thrown around at black people. They are using sort of the dog whistles that we've come to expect.
As turmoil over the presidential election continues in the U.S., it's easy to forget that coronavirus and a gutted economy are also long-running issues. Now seems certain that a much-needed second household stimulus will not arrive until 2021, on top of the other problems across the country. Robin Mazahiri is in Chicago.
The United States is in turmoil, seemingly everywhere one looks. Trump's unprecedented insistence that the vote undergo a judicial review is causing unprecedented soul-searching about the integrity of elections, which Harvard's Electoral Integrity Project called in 2019, the worst among the Western core democracies.
What Trump did that you simply don't do in the United States in a government of two capitalist parties is that he questioned the legitimacy of the election process. And between two capitalist parties, it's in both of their interests to maintain order, to maintain that legitimacy. And by him calling out the process, you've seen that people, some of his biggest cheerleaders like Fox News, the Wall Street Journal editorial board, they have distanced themselves from Trump. Some like Fox News even going as far as aligning with the other media, saying that Joe Biden is the president-elect.
Adding to the political chaos is that the expected second wave of coronavirus continues to rage. That leads to more lockdown measures, which exacerbates the ongoing economic disaster. So Americans have many reasons to be concerned.
Many areas will start stay-at-home advisories, not orders, next week.
The Trump administration has backed off from second stimulus negotiations, leaving it entirely in the hands of a divided Congress. Record unemployment and 9 months of uneven and economically devastating lockdowns has made a second stimulus so important for so long, but households now shouldn't hope for assistance until perhaps February 2021. But it's a judicial review of the presidential vote which seems to be at the top of everyone's list, and it's supported by not just conservatives, but many independents and leftists as well.
They have to absolutely count every vote. They have to verify the wins that, you know, the media projected that these wins to be. It has to be set in stone. The United States has a track record of very weird, not great elections. The world sees this. The people in the United States sees this. This would be a good opportunity for both parties to kind of say, like, look, we have to set this in stone. We have to look at every single vote. And we have to come out and announce a winner. We can't let the media decide who is the projected winner. That's for certain.
Many are refusing to postpone electoral integrity questions any longer, but many Democrats are insisting that there was no vote fraud and that Biden is the president-elect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
COVID-19 pandemic continues to wreak havoc across the Americas, where countries struggle to contain the spread of the deadly virus. According to Johns Hopkins University's tally, the U.S.'s total death toll has surpassed 245,000, with the confirmed cases nearing 10,900,000. The surge in cases has prompted several states to announce new restrictions. On Friday, the U.S. reported a record of over 184,000 new cases in one day. In Brazil, officials registered over 38,000 new cases, raising the country's total infections to nearly 5.85 million. They also reported over 900 new deaths, taking the death toll to more than 165,000. Both the U.S. president and his Brazilian counterpart have come under sharp criticism for mishandling the pandemic. The coronavirus outbreak in Europe shows no sign of abating despite stringent measures put in place by several countries. We discussed that situation with our guests in our News Review program.
The novel coronavirus infections and deaths continue to soar throughout Europe despite restrictions imposed by governments to try to curb the pandemic. Britain registered nearly 27,000 new infections in the past 24 hours. 462 more people also died throughout that same time period. Italy reported over 37,000 new infections and 541 deaths. Russia's daily infections also hit an all-time high with nearly 23,000 new cases. The country's total tally stands currently at over 1.9 million infections. Poland also reported a record high of 548 new deaths. A surge in cases has led to a new wave of lockdowns across Europe. Austria says it will move from its current nighttime coronavirus curfew and partial shutdown to a full lockdown from Tuesday until December the 6th. Greece also announced the closure of nurseries and primary schools until the end of November. Meanwhile, German police have used water cannons to disperse protesters during a protest against lockdown measures in Frankfurt. Police said the rally was broken up after protesters repeatedly disregarded distancing guidelines. Protest was attended by hundreds of people from the Girden Care movement, which opposes the government's measures to contain spread of COVID-19. Police clashed with a group of counter-protesters who blocked the route of the rally several times. The German health minister has warned the event that even, pardon, with the current stringent measures, lowering the infection rate will take quite a long time. The country has so far reported over 788,000 coronavirus cases with more than 12,000 deaths. And now joining us for this news review is Max Civelli from Rowe and Bijan Tavassoli, member of Germany's left party, joining us out of Hamburg. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start with our correspondent there. Max, give us the latest out of Rome, bud.
Well, Italy continues to struggle with a worsening coronavirus situation in many parts of the country. The regions of Campania and Tuscany were designated as high-risk red zones. Today, two more regions declared red zones. Three more regions, the Emilia-Romagna, Friuli, and Marche, went from being yellow to medium-risk orange zones. As you said before, we had 37,000 new COVID-19 cases today, but there were 41,000 new infections recorded yesterday. Mm. It was the highest toll in the second wave of coronavirus, and there are now over 30,000 patients in hospital with symptoms, and this is very worrying. Health authorities have repeatedly warned that hospitals across the entire country, and particularly in hard-hit areas such as Milan and Naples, are struggling to cope with a large number of patients. Consider that in Rome, we also have here in Rome medical beds have been lacking in the last few days, and there's been a blockade of ambulance at the entrance of emergency rooms. In the north, intensive care units are struggling with receiving more and more patients. So they have at this stage about 800 patients in intensive care, and this is very worrying, considering that the health system is starting to be overwhelmed.
Thank you, Max. And Bijan, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Tell us what's going on in Germany.
The situation in Germany is similarly dire as in Italy, and it's getting worse by the day. On Monday, the federal government will reconvene with the heads of the 16 Bundesländer to decide on how to continue with the so-called current lockdown light, which is scheduled to go on for the rest of November. And as it stands now, the numbers do not seem to be low enough that any measures can be changed so far. So there's even discussions of increasing the measures, as we have seen in Austria, for example, where they're now moving from a so-called lockdown light to a hard lockdown, where the life in public is really diminished. And with the current cases increasing, hospitals are projected to actually reach capacity, and so some other non-essential operations are not going to be scheduled anymore, which is a great problem for the German healthcare system.
And Bijan, what are the Germans doing right? Because you look at the rest of you, I mean, you look at Spain, you look at Italy, you look at France, you look at the UK, they're all over 30, 40,000 deaths and counting. You look at Iran, same thing. So, but you look at Germany, they only have, what, about 12,500 deaths so far. So tell me, what is Berlin doing that the rest of the world isn't?
Well, it's two factors. First of all, it's blind luck. You talked about Iran. Iran was one of the first countries to be hit by the epidemic after China. And Germany had much more time to react. The politicians in Berlin didn't make maximum use of that time. But if you have time to react, that plays a role. And the second factor, which is not talked about so much, is the structure of families. In the southern European states, many families live together. You live together with your grandparents, for example, and that is considered a family tradition in southern Europe. In Germany and in northern European countries, there is much more distance, and family members might live apart and see each other only once a year. So that, of course, leads to younger people, when they get the infection, it's much harder for them to spread it to their grandparents. And it's, according to all the studies, it's mostly the older people who die in disproportionate numbers. So the social distancing that everyone is talking about now in Germany, between the younger and the older generations, it's been happening for a long time.
Gentlemen, I want to wish you both be safe. Thank you both for joining us on the program. Max Civili from Rome and Mr. Bijan Tamasuli joining us from Hamburg. And that's a wrap for this segment of your news review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. Austria's Muslim community says the government's attempt to criminalize what it terms political Islam is alarming. Following the Vienna terror attack, the Austrian government has presented a package of proposals that includes keeping detainees in prison indefinitely, closing mosques, and tracking imams. Homa Lizgi is in Vienna.
Just over a week after the Vienna terror attack, Austria's government proposed legislation to keep terrorism detainees locked up indefinitely, Chancellor Sebastian Kurz called them ticking time bombs.
Like mentally abnormal lawbreakers, we will also make it possible in the future to block these people's path and thus protect the population from them.
But the most controversial part of the new measures is the creation of a new criminal offense that the government calls political Islam. If approved, this law would make it easier to close mosques or detain imams on charges of creating the breeding ground for terrorism. The Islamic faith community of Austria, representing around 700,000 people, says some of the measures are incompatible with the constitution and fundamental human rights. Prominent Muslim personalities have raised alarm on social media. The Muslim population has the impression that the term political Islam is used as a kind of code to send signals to certain groups of voters and foster resentment. There can't be a penalty that addresses only one religion, an activist said. The Muslim community is still deeply shocked by the terrorist attack.
Islamic cemeteries here denied the perpetrator of the Vienna attack a funeral to show that they not only strongly condemn the attack, but also the perpetrator who carried out the crime in the name of Islam. The imams of mosques here instead carried the casket of a young Muslim who was among the four people killed.
But in the days following the attack, more Muslims are reporting cases of abuse, both on the streets and on social media. The important thing now, says the Islamic community, is that society does not allow itself to be divided. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Pakistan has come up with a diplomatic dossier by detailing of what it calls hard and specific evidence of Indian involvement in terrorism across the region. Islamabad's evidence through its dossier has come at the heel of a major escalation at its borders with India in disputed Kashmir region. Javed Rana reports.
Fresh border clashes have erupted in disputed Kashmir region, divided between both nuclear-armed Pakistan and India. This is the aftermath scene of a major border escalation. Over a dozen houses were burned to ashes when Indian military carried out mortar and rocket attacks on civilian population. One Pakistani soldier and five civilians died, while 33 others were injured. In retaliation, five Indian troops were reportedly killed. Many have migrated from the troubled bordering region to safer areas after heavy skirmishes. The border tension has been high between two neighbors since August last year, when India forcibly annexed its part of disputed Kashmir region into its federation. The merger of only Indian majority state was done in defiance of 11 UN Security Council resolutions, which call for a referendum to let people decide on whether they want to stay with India or join Pakistan. Pakistan has come up with a comprehensive dossier providing specific details of what it calls Indian aggression, fast reaching to its mainland from Kashmir region through different terrorist outfits. India also blames Pakistan for supporting what it calls terrorism in its controlled Kashmir region. The battlegrounds between Pakistan and India seems to have spread far beyond disputed Kashmir region. Citing intelligence reports, Islamabad has blamed New Delhi to have set up 87 terrorist camps, 21 in India and 66 in Afghanistan. Officials here say that India has also recruited over 700 militants, including those of Daesh terrorists, to carry out terrorism in Pakistan and false flag operations across the region. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. Two United Nations agencies on Tuesday, November 10th, highlighted concerns about how the coronavirus pandemic is impacting global hunger and population displacement, warning that both could surge as people on the move and those reliant on a dwindling flow of remittances desperately seek work to support their families. We have prepared an article for you in this regard written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading UN Agencies Warn of Global Hunger and Displacement Surge from Coronavirus Pandemic. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Two United Nations agencies on Tuesday, November 10th, highlighted concerns about how the coronavirus pandemic is impacting global hunger and population displacement, warning that both could surge as people on the move and those reliant on a dwindling flow of remittances desperately seek work to support their families. The first-of-its-kind report from the International Organization for Migration, IOM, and the UN World Food Programme, WFP, is entitled Populations at Risk, Implications of COVID-19 for Hunger, Migration and Displacement. It comes as the number of cases across the globe nears 51 million and after more than 1.26 million deaths. The report examines recent migration trends, the pandemic's impact on migrant workers, remittance-dependent households, and forcibly displaced persons, growing risks to people on the move, and food security trends in major migration and hunger hotspots. It also details recommended actions for the international community. Agency leaders note in the report that the pandemic has hit at a time when hunger has been on the rise over four consecutive years, mainly due to conflict, climate-related shocks, and economic crises. At the same time, forced displacement has reached record high. As Common Dreams has reported, the UN Refugee Agency revealed in June that an unprecedented 79.5 million people worldwide were forcibly displaced by the end of last year, including 26 million refugees, 45.7 million internally displaced persons or IDPs, 4.2 million asylum seekers. A September analysis from an international think tank predicted that ecological disasters and armed conflicts could forcibly displace 10% of humanity, or about 1.2 billion people, by 2050. Those findings came in the midst of the ongoing public health crisis, but the new WFP-IOM report specifically focuses on it. The foreword says that while overall mobility is expected to decline in 2020 due to the pandemic, it may ultimately increase over time, as more people will be compelled to move if they can no longer make ends meet in their current location. Thus, well-governed migration, as outlined by the United Nations Network on Migration, is an essential component of an effective response to COVID-19. The report is fully grounded in the vision of the Global Compact for Safe, Orderly, and Regular Migration, which underscores that migration should never be an act of desperation, writes Aref Hossein, Chief Economist and Director of Research at WFP's Assessment and Monitoring Division, and Jeffrey Labovitz, Director of IOM's Department of Operations and Emergencies. Migrants and displaced populations facing acute hardship due to COVID-19 must be provided with support that enables them to meet their food and other essential needs. IOM Director General Antonio Vitorino warned in a statement that the impact of the COVID-19 crisis on health and human mobility threatens to roll back global commitments, including for the Global Compact on Migration, and hinder ongoing efforts to support those in need of assistance. It is our collective responsibility to safeguard the rights of people on the move and ensure their protection from further harm. Specifically, the report offers 8 recommendations to global community. Ensure migrants facing acute hardship can access humanitarian assistance in order to meet their food and other essential needs. Safeguard assistance provided to the displaced and their host communities, including refugees and asylum seekers, IDPs, as well as migrants in crisis situations and those in mixed flows. Secure access to critical services and inclusive information for all mobile and displaced populations. Recognize the positive contributions of migrants and diaspora and promote their inclusion in social protection systems. Facilitate the flow of remittances as an essential financial service that appears the response to and recovery from the impact of COVID-19. Promote necessary adjustments to national legal frameworks and ensure access to legal services. Counter xenophobia, stigmatization, and discrimination towards people on the move in the wake of COVID-19. And improve data and analysis to better understand the impacts of COVID-19 in mobility, remittances, and food security dynamics. The socioeconomic impact of the pandemic is more devastating than the disease itself, said WFP Executive Director David Beasley. Many people in low and middle income countries who a few months ago were poor but just about getting by now find their livelihoods have been destroyed. Remittances sent from workers abroad to their families at home have also dried up, causing immense hardship. As a result, hunger rates are skyrocketing around the world. Last week, WFP issued a report with the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, which describes a toxic combination of conflict, economic decline, climate extremes, and the COVID-19 pandemic that is driving people further into the emergency phase of food insecurity, according to a joint statement from the UN agencies. The WFP and FAO called for urgent global aid to address the rising risk of famine in food insecurity hotspots within Burkina Faso, northeastern Nigeria, South Sudan, and Yemen, as well as hunger levels across 16 countries. As Margot van der Velden, WFP's Director of Emergencies, put it, "We are at a catastrophic turning point. This report is a clear call to urgent action." Dominique Bergen, FAO's Director of Emergencies and Resilience, said recently, "We are deeply concerned about the combined impact of several crises which are eroding people's ability to produce and access food, leaving more and more at risk of the most extreme hunger. We need access to these populations to ensure they have food and means to produce food and improve their livelihoods to prevent a worst-case scenario."
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners, and here is a wonderful stimulation for our thoughts from Imam Hadi, peace be upon him, the 10th infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Better than the good deed is its doer, and nicer than the